Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... This week's episode might feel a little like a greatest hits compilation, listener. All the usual suspects will be up for discussion. Israel's Schrödinger annexation plan, which, while ambiguous and universally denounced, remains both dead and alive. The coronavirus in Israel, where tens of thousands of people were sent quarantine orders by the Shin Bet over the weekend, and which has just recorded its largest single-day increase in active COVID-19 cases. And returning to the headlines after an uncharacteristic few months of quiet, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is blaming Israel, of all countries, for a fire at its uranium enrichment plant in Natanz. Joining me today, it's Anshul Pfeffer. How's it going, mate?
Not too bad, yourself?
Most excellent, most excellent. Anshul, last week you took a road trip across the West Bank and you wrote an excellent piece of reportage. For me, the most telling line in the whole piece was the very last one. The store owner in Nablus who told you that he doesn't believe that Netanyahu will annex the West Bank, like you predicted 2 months ago. But either way, he said it's got nothing to do with the Palestinians. That's a very depressing viewpoint. Is that prevalent?
It's prevalent amongst Palestinians, but let's be fair, it's prevalent amongst Israelis as well, with the exception of, you know, a rather small, hardcore of the right wing, who some of them were settlers and some of them are just very much, very involved in the, you know, in the future of the settlement. I'd say that 90% of Israelis aren't really worked up about annexation. We've seen various polls saying that only 4% or 5% of Israelis think that it should even be an issue right now when Israel's and the whole world is dealing with the pandemic and the economic downturn. So, as I heard in various parts of the West Bank, most Palestinians don't think this, you know, this regards them in any major way. But as you and I know, it's the same thing with Israelis.
Maybe that was reflected in what happened to today's editorial meeting, where someone suggested that the whole annexation issue is passé, that we don't need any more op-eds or podcasts on the subject. But others argued that while it may have disappeared from the Israeli headlines, the international media continues to be obsessed, and there have been demonstrations from Auckland to Copenhagen to Washington.
You know, the international media has to work, you know, when you're covering, you know, when you're an international media organization, you're covering dozens of countries and you have to, you know, so you have to plan in advance, you know, where you're putting your resources and reporters and satellite times, etc. So this has been something that's been marked down in the calendars of every major news organization, July the 1st, and, you know, the build up towards July the 1st, and then the blowback and the implications, so on and so forth. So there's been this whole 3 or 4 days planned around it, and I know at least one news organization, which was on July the 1st last week, set up a whole live broadcast position somewhere near the Green Line, expecting there to be some kind of action, or I don't know what kind of convoys or demonstrations on the, you know, out in the field, and there was nothing for them to film there, so that was a bit of a letdown. And I think for you mentioned demonstrations being held in various places across the world. This has been a rare chance for a certain type of pro-Palestinian radical left wing tendency to flex its muscles, whether, you know, thanks to a bit of international media attention that the Israel-Palestine issue has received, thanks to this July the 1st annexation date. So, you know, it was obvious that there would be these demonstrations, but at the end of the day, I think we as an Israeli newspaper need to tell the truth, and the truth is, as I've been saying for the last couple of months, is that the chances of an annexation ever happening were very low, and lo and behold, it hadn't happened, and it began to disappear from our agenda.
So apart from I told you so, what have we still got to say about the annexation?
I think what's interesting is the inherent contradictions that we've seen here, both within Israeli politics and in the Israel-US relationship. Netanyahu wanted to use this issue to rally his base during the election. And we don't have enough polling, retrospective polling, to know whether this issue was useful for him. But Netanyahu was obviously trying to really scrape together every last vote he could bring from his reservoir of right-wing voters. So he obviously thought that annexation was one way of bringing some reluctant voters. But that has since metamorphosed into a much bigger issue, which was partly the Trump plan and the whole date of July the 1st and what would be annexed. Would it be the 30% of the West Bank, which the Trump plan said would be part of Israel in the future, or would it be smaller, more symbolic, perhaps, part of the West Bank? So all this dynamic was happening very much.
I read one analysis this morning, Angel, which started with the question, why is Netanyahu so keen on annexation? Would it be fairer to say that Bibi's blown hot and cold on the issue, depending on how well or otherwise it serves him?
That's very fair to say. I'm not sure which piece you're referring to, but I don't think Netanyahu is eager to annex. He hasn't been for most of the 14 years in total that he's been in power. Most of these 14 years, when it's been brought up in meetings with him, he's sort of like tried to push it off the agenda and say, "Oh, we don't really need to do that. We're in control anyway. Don't worry, I'm in control of the West Bank. You don't need to actually annex it." It only came up very momentarily on the eve of the previous three consecutive elections, and I don't think it would have been an issue right now if it hadn't been for this feeling amongst some on the right that as Donald Trump is almost at the end of his first and perhaps only term as president, this need to grab something to try and take advantage of this once in a lifetime, once in a century opportunity to move the Overton window in Israel's favor. And I think that window's already moved, and Netanyahu's taken advantage of it. But I think Netanyahu was perhaps enthusiastic for annexation and for a legacy, perhaps only for a few weeks, in which he sort of lost his usual sense of pragmatism and risk averseness. And I think we're already back to the old Netanyahu, someone said the good old Netanyahu, who doesn't take rash steps of annexation that easily.
Mm. So it's safe to assume that Boris Johnson's front page op-ed for Yediot Ahronot wasn't what finally persuaded Bibi to roll in the annexation flag.
No, I think that by the time Boris Johnson's piece was published in Israel, it was already clear to Netanyahu and those and other senior ministers that nothing going to happen on July the 1st, and nothing was probably going to be happening anytime soon. And for Boris Johnson has a sense of timing as the performer, not so much as a politician, but he certainly knew the right time to publish this piece
on July the first.
I don't think this had any effect on Netanyahu. I think Netanyahu knew already then that the British government is not very keen on annexation, like almost any other foreign government, with perhaps the exception of the United States, not even that for certain. Netanyahu did not need to read Boris in Yediot Ahronot. He can talk to him over the phone, and he does. And the same is true of any other pressure group, small or large, which has been making noise about annexation in recent weeks and months. But I think one of the biggest dangers here, especially for the left wing, is that people will start to think that it was thanks to our pressure on Israel that didn't happen. And no, the only reason it didn't happen is that Netanyahu realized he doesn't have the backing of the American administration. And more crucially, within 6 months, there may be a different administration led by Joe Biden, which will remember what Netanyahu had done in the last few months of the Trump presidency. And if that would have been an annexation, then he would have started his relationship with this new administration on a very... in a very disadvantageous position, which I don't think Netanyahu wants. Netanyahu now reads polls. He's a voracious poll reader, and he knows that the chances of Trump winning a second term are decreasing by the day.
So while we're waiting to hear what Kanye West has to say about annexation. The main candidate, Joe Biden, has come out against it, right? He's warned Israel against annexation, but stopped short.
He warned it both himself and his foreign policy advisors have been very vocal about their opposition to it. But there's also been a bit of an olive branch in the sense that they've said some of Biden's people that if he wins, he won't necessarily roll back everything that Donald Trump did in this region. For example, he won't necessarily say that the embassy will be moved back to Tel Aviv. He'll probably say, well, since my predecessor Trump moved it, then I'm not going to move it back again. And you know, so Israel will be able to keep something from the Trump legacy. Even after Donald Trump releases the world from his toxic presence and leaves the White House,
Will Biden be able to withstand pressure from the left of his party? The AOC's written a letter calling on the United States to reconsider its aid if Israel goes ahead with annexation, which is strong language, the threat doesn't really exist.
You're talking about 4 or 5 out of the entire Democratic congressional delegation. I don't think that's something. Biden so far hasn't seemed to be, and that's probably one of the reasons why he's doing so well now in the polls. Doesn't seem to be so easily cowed by that part of the Democratic Party. And I think we should all be I think that seems to be a good political tactic for him. You know, whether or not the U.S. decides to change its current policy of subsidizing its own arms industry by $38 billion a decade just so Israel can buy a few cheaper arms that Israel doesn't even need is a question that's not something that will be decided by various Congress members. I think it's something that Israeli and the American leadership should have a serious conversation about. Israel doesn't need a lot of the arms that it buys from the States, but consecutive, successive administrations, including as recently Obama, has all wanted to give billions to their own arms industry and make it seem that this was aid to Israel. But this is a whole different issue.
You've also written, Anshul, that Netanyahu's gravest concern over a possible Biden presidency is the revival of the Iranian nuclear deal. And lo and behold, the lead story in Haaretz this morning is about a fire at an Iranian nuclear facility. Coincidence?
Nothing is coincidence, but that is Netanyahu's biggest concern. His concern is not that the Americans are going to cut off military aid. He knows very well that that's done for the benefit of America's arms industries and not for Israel. And his worry is not so much annexation anymore, which was never a big issue. His worry was and remains American policy over Iran, which is why he's going to be very careful not to anger an incoming president too much, and it's why I think we can be pretty sure that the issue of the annexation is almost off the table. Netanyahu will talk about it, perhaps it's politically advantageous for him to use it as a distraction from other things like his own corruption trial and probably new investigations down the road and the mismanagement of the pandemic. But will it happen? No, it probably won't happen.
So can we promise our listeners that this will be the last podcast for a while that will deal with annexation?
That's what I want to ever be on again,
We promised our listeners that we would end off with a little bit of corona news, Anshul. The cabinet is currently meeting in Jerusalem to discuss reimposing restrictions on public gathering. And over the weekend, 30,000 Israelis were sent messages instructing them to self-quarantine after the Shin Bet digital tracking system reported that they'd been in close proximity to confirmed patients. According to our reporters, though, many of those who got the messages say they were home at the time and they have no means of appealing the order. Just the standard snafu, situation normal, all fucked up?
It's not at all a standard snafu. We know very well that the Shin Bet surveillance capability were tailored for a certain type of scenario. They weren't tailored to locate people who are infecting each other with a virus. They were located to track people who were carrying explosives or other kind of nefarious purposes. And that kind of system is not, you know, is good for tracking people at certain distances, but not the kind of proximity that people infect each other with viruses. Last time the Shin Bet surveillance was used, we had many reports of people saying, I was at home asleep or with my family, and suddenly I get this message saying that that when I was home, I was actually in contact with someone carrying the virus, but there's nothing I can do about it. There's no way to appeal, and we're having the very same thing happening again, and it was only to be expected the moment the Shin Bet system would be turned back on again for corona use, we'd be having all these, what we can assume are erroneous detections. And this is one of the reasons why the Shin Bet themselves have been against using their system for fighting coronavirus. And it highlights the total failure of the Netanyahu government to set up a proper contact tracing apparatus that will do what other countries are trying to do. And it has to be said, most countries are finding it difficult to set up some kind of contact tracing system. But using the Shin Bet is, you know, it's like trying to use a regular screwdriver for a Phillips screw. It's not the right kind of...
Wrong tool for the wrong job.
It's totally the wrong tool for the wrong job. And ironically, at the same time, Netanyahu is saying we won't use the resources of the IDF for fighting corona because he doesn't want Benny Gantz, who's our defense minister, to get too much credit for that. But there are actually things, especially which the IDF, you know, resources that the IDF has, especially when it comes to the home command, that could be very useful in fighting a pandemic. Mm. But since the Shin Bet is under Netanyahu's direct control, and he wants to use that rather than the IDF. Mm. And we're going to see a lot more of this on the way back into another shot, into another lockdown, because it's obvious that Israel is headed that way. Mm.
I don't know if you saw the report that Sky News' Middle East correspondent Mark Stone filed over the weekend, Angel. He basically used Israel as a cautionary tale for the rest of the world on how not to handle lockdown easing. Is that fair, accurate?
It's fair, and I think this we'll be seeing more similar features in international media in the next few days. Israel's very, very quickly moved from being one of the few countries which dealt well with the first wave to being one of the countries which is really a parable for how not to deal with the second wave.
Mm. Once again, we are a net news exporter. Anshul, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Simon.
We'll talk again soon. Listener, that's all we have for this week. My thanks to Anshul Pfeffer, to producer Aaron, and to you for joining us. We'll be back again next week with another episode. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.